You are listening to the Pronk Pop Show, presented by Raymond Thomas Pronk, the People's Paladin Pronk, propagating faith, family, friends, freedom first. Broadcasted by Renaissance Radio, Radiating Reason, and KDUX Web Radio. Podcasted by ProncPops.wordpress.com and KDUXWebRadio.wordpress.com. You are listening to KDUX Web Radio, broadcasting live from Richland College in Dallas, Texas, with a voice of Richland College. My name is Raymond Thomas Pronk, the presenter of the Pronk Pop Show. Views expressed on this show are my own, unless otherwise stated, and do not reflect the opinion of KDUX Web Radio, Richland College, or the Dallas County Community College District. Welcome to the Pronk Pop Show. This is the Thursday edition, and just a brief announcement. We are on a summer schedule, so we do not have shows on Friday. The studio is completely closed, so I want to bring that to your attention if you're a regular listener. Today, I want to do a show dedicated to the 75th anniversary commemorating the D-Day invasion. And I am going to play President Trump's remarks, but I also was thinking, what got us there? And the reason I say that, if you know the history of the 1930s, you know we went through the Great Depression, and the overwhelming public sentiment was to stay out of any war in Europe. It's called isolationism. I prefer to call it non-interventionism. And that was the overwhelming sentiment. So something had to fundamentally change. Now, many of you are going to say, well, wait a minute. The Japanese attacked us at Pearl Harbor. That did it. Yes, but you always have to go back. Well, why did they attack us? And remember, we were still in a recession. Unemployment was high, over 10%. Close to 15%. So one way to get out of any depression or recession is to go to war, especially if you're a big advocate of bigger and bigger government. And both Hoover and FDR, they both were progressives and they both were for big government. That might surprise some of you, but that's just the facts. And they really hadn't. Everything they've tried, Hoover was an interventionist, so was FDR, failed. We really didn't get out of the Great Depression, recession until 1946, after the war, and after FDR died in 45. So I want to first focus in on the 75th anniversary and the President Trump's remarks, but then revisit, how did those men that gave their lives, was it willingly? No, not really. The state coerced them. Oh yeah, there were plenty of volunteers. I understand that. But many more were drafted. The state, the federal government, had to draft people to fight a war. And the same thing was in Germany. Same thing in Stalin's Russia. We had three large states. And as I always say, governments kill people. All governments kill people. You need to be sensitive to that and aware of what's going on. So first, let's hear President Trump's remarks honoring our U.S. heroes that attacked on that day, June 6, 1944.
President Macron, Mrs. Macron, and the people of France, to the First Lady of the United States, and members of the United States Congress, to distinguished guests, veterans, and my fellow Americans, we are gathered here on freedom's altar, on these shores, on these bluffs, on this day, 75 years ago, 10,000 men shed their blood and thousands sacrificed their lives for their brothers, for their countries, and for the survival of liberty. Today we remember those who fell and we honor all who fought right here in Normandy. They won back this ground for civilization to more than 170 veterans of the Second World War who join us today. You are among the very greatest Americans who will ever live. You are the pride of our nation. You are the glory of our republic. And we thank you from the bottom of our hearts. Here with you are over 60 veterans who landed on D-Day. Our debt to you is everlasting. Today we express our undying gratitude. When you were young, these men enlisted their lives in a great crusade, one of the greatest of all times. Their mission is the story of an epic battle and the ferocious, eternal struggle between good and evil. On the 6th of June, 1944, they joined a liberation force of awesome power and breathtaking scale. After months of planning, the Allies had chosen this ancient coastline to mount their campaign to vanquish the wicked tyranny of the Nazi Empire from the face of the earth. The battle began in the skies above us. In those first tense midnight hours, 1,000 aircraft roared overhead with 17,000 Allied airborne troops preparing to leap into the darkness beyond these trees. Then came dawn. The enemy who had occupied these heights saw the largest naval armada in the history of the world. Just a few miles offshore were 7,000 vessels bearing 130,000 warriors. They were the citizens of free and independent nations united by their duty to their compatriots and to millions yet unborn. There were the British whose nobility and fortitude saw them through the worst of Dunkirk and the London Blitz. The full violence of Nazi fury was no match for the full grandeur of British pride. Thank you. There were the Canadians, whose robust sense of honor and loyalty compel them to take up arms alongside Britain from the very, very beginning. There were the fighting Poles, the tough Norwegians, and the intrepid Aussies. There were the gallant French commandos, soon to be met by thousands of their brave countrymen ready to write a new chapter in the long history of French valor. And finally, there were the Americans. They came from the farms of a vast heartland, the streets of glowing cities, and the forges of mighty industrial towns. Before the war, many had never ventured beyond their own community. Now they had come to offer their lives half a world from home. This beach, codenamed Omaha, was defended by the Nazis with monstrous firepower, thousands and thousands of mines and spikes driven into the sand so deeply. It was here that tens of thousands of the Americans came the GIs who boarded the landing craft that morning knew that they carried on their shoulders not just the pack of a soldier, but the fate of the world. Colonel George Taylor, whose 16th Infantry Regiment would join in the first wave, was asked what would happen if the Germans stopped. Right then and there, cold on the beach, just stopped them. What would happen? This great American replied, "Why, the 18th Infantry is coming in right behind us. The 26th Infantry will come on too. Then there is the 2nd Infantry Division, already afloat, and the 9th Division, and the 2nd Armored, and the 3rd Armored, and all the rest. Maybe the 16th won't make it, but someone will." One of those men in Taylor's 16th Regiment was Army Medic Ray Lambert. Ray was only 23, but he had already earned 3 Purple Hearts and 2 Silver Stars fighting in North Africa and Sicily, where he and his brother Bill, no longer with us, served side by side. In the early morning hours, the two brothers stood together on the deck of the USS Henrico before boarding 2 separate Higgins landing craft. "If I don't make it," Bill said, "please, please, take care of my family." Ray asked his brother to do the same. Of the 31 men on Ray's landing craft, only Ray and 6 others made it to the beach. There were only a few of them left. They came to the sector right here below us. Easy Red, it was called. Again and again, Ray ran back into the water. He dragged out one man after another. He was shot through the arm. His leg was ripped open by shrapnel. His back was broken. He nearly drowned. He had been on the beach for hours, bleeding and saving lives, when he finally lost consciousness. He woke up the next day on a cot beside another badly wounded soldier. He looked over and saw his brother Bill. They made it. They made it. They made it. At 98 years old, Ray is here with us today with his 4th Purple Heart and his 3rd Silver Star from Omaha. Ray, the free world salutes you. Nearly 2 hours in, unrelenting fire from these bluffs kept the Americans pinned down on the sand, now red with our heroes' blood. Then, just a few hundred yards from where I'm standing, a breakthrough came. The battle turned, and with it, history. Down on the beach, Captain Joe Dawson, the son of a Texas preacher, led Company G through a minefield to a natural fold in the hillside, still here. Just beyond this path, to my right, Captain Dawson snuck beneath an enemy machine gun perch and tossed his grenades. Soon, American troops were charging up Dawson's draw. What a job he did. What bravery he showed. Lieutenant Spaulding and the men from Company E moved on to crush the enemy strong point on the far side of this cemetery and stop the slaughter on the beach below. Countless more Americans poured out across this ground all over the countryside. They joined fellow American warriors from Utah Beach and allies from Juneau, Sword and Gold, along with the Airborne and the French Patriots. Private First Class Russell Pickett of the 29th Division's famed 116th Infantry Regiment had been wounded in the first wave that landed on Omaha Beach. At a hospital in England, Private Pickett vowed to return to battle. "I'm going to return," he said. "I'm going to return." 6 days after D-Day, he rejoined his company. Two-thirds had been killed already. Many had been wounded within 15 minutes of the invasion. They lost 19 just from the small town of Bedford, Virginia alone. Before long, a grenade left Private Pickett, and he was gravely wounded, so badly wounded. Again, he chose to return. He didn't care. He had to be here. He was then wounded a third time and laid unconscious for 12 days. They thought he was gone. They thought he had no chance. Russell Pickett is the last known survivor of the legendary Company A. And today, believe it or not, he has returned once more to these shores to be with his comrades. Private Pickett, you honor us all with your presence. Tough guy. By the fourth week of August, Paris was liberated. Some who landed here pushed all the way to the center of Germany. Some threw open the gates of Nazi concentration camps to liberate Jews who had suffered the bottomless horrors of the Holocaust. And some warriors fell on other fields of battle, returning to rest on this soil for eternity. Before this place was consecrated to history, the land was owned by a French farmer, a member of the French resistance. These were great people. These were strong and tough people. His terrified wife waited out D-Day in a nearby house, holding tight to their little baby girl. The next day, a soldier appeared. "I'm an American," he said. "I'm here to help." The French woman was overcome with emotion and cried. Days later, she laid flowers on fresh American graves. Today, her granddaughter, Stephanie, serves as a guide at this cemetery. This week, Stephanie led 92-year-old Marion Nguyen of California to see the grave of her brother Don for the very first time. Marion and Stephanie are both with us today, and we thank you for keeping alive the memories of our precious heroes. Thank you. ...9,388 young Americans rest beneath the white crosses and Stars of David, arrayed on these beautiful grounds. Each one has been adopted by a French family that thinks of him as their own. They come from all over France to look after our boys. They kneel, they cry, they pray, they place flowers, and they never forget. Today, America embraces the French people and thanks you for honoring our beloved dead. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. To all of our friends and partners, our cherished alliance was forged in the heat of battle, tested in the trials of war, and proven in the blessings of peace. Our bond is unbreakable. From across the earth, Americans are drawn to this place as though it were a part of our very soul. We come not only because of what they did here. We come because of who they were. They were young men with their entire lives before them. They were husbands who said goodbye to their young brides and took their duty as their fate. They were fathers who would never meet their infant sons and daughters because they had a job to do. And with God as their witness, they were going to get it done. They came wave after wave, without question, without hesitation, and without complaint. More powerful than the strength of American arms was the strength of American hearts. These men ran through the fires of hell, moved by a force no weapon could destroy. the fierce patriotism of a free, proud, and sovereign people. They battled not for control and domination, but for liberty, democracy, and self-rule. They pressed on for love and home and country, the main streets, the schoolyards, the churches, and neighbors, the families and communities that gave us men such as these. They were sustained by the confidence that America can do anything, because we are a noble nation with a virtuous people praying to a righteous God. The exceptional might came from a truly exceptional spirit. The abundance of courage came from an abundance of faith. The great deeds of an army came from the great depths of their love. As they confronted their fate, the Americans and the Allies placed themselves into the palm of God's hand. The men behind me will tell you that they are just the lucky ones. As one of them recently put it, all the heroes are buried here. But we know what these men did. We knew how brave they were. They came here and saved freedom. And then they went home and showed us all what freedom is all about. The American sons and daughters who saw us to victory were no less extraordinary in peace. They built families. They built industries. They built a national culture that inspired the entire world. In the decades that followed, America defeated communism, secured civil rights, revolutionized science, launched a man to the moon, and then kept on pushing to new frontiers. And today, America is stronger than ever before. Seven decades ago, the warriors of D-Day fought a sinister enemy who spoke of a thousand-year empire. In defeating that evil, they left a legacy that will last not only for a thousand years, but for all time. For as long as the soul knows of duty and honor, for as long as freedom keeps its hold on the human heart. To the men who sit behind me and to the boys who rest in the field before me, your example will never, ever grow old. Your legend will never die. Your spirit, brave, unyielding, and true, will never die. The blood that they spilled, the tears that they shed, the lives that they gave, the sacrifice that they made, did not just win a battle. It did not just win a war. Those who fought here won a future for our nation. They won the survival of our civilization. And they showed us the way to love, cherish, and defend our way of life for many centuries to come. Today, as we stand together upon this sacred earth. We pledge that our nation will forever be strong and united. We will forever be together. Our people will forever be bold. Our hearts will forever be loyal. And our children and their children will forever and always be free. May God bless our great veterans. May God bless our allies.
That was President Trump today honoring the veterans of D-Day. There are fewer and fewer. Keep in mind, most of the people that are still surviving are in their early to mid-90s. This is the 75th anniversary. Most of them were 18, 19, 20-year-olds. So they're in their 90s. And by the 100th anniversary, they would be approaching 120. I don't think there are going to be many people at the 100th anniversary that were there. There's still a few World War II veterans of D-Day that are still living, but they're fewer and fewer each year as the World War II generation dies. And we need to honor them, remember their sacrifice. But we need to learn from history, because Roosevelt, together with Churchill, were trying to get the American people involved in the European War, primarily. But they had a big problem. The sentiment in the United States in the 1930s, really 1920s going into the 1930s, the American people wanted no part of another world war in Europe. And that was the overwhelming sentiment. So how did it change? And the whole attitude, view, changed in one single day, and that day was on December 7th, 1941, when there was a so-called surprise attack on Pearl Harbor. But was it really a surprise? Actually, it was provoked by President Roosevelt. They knew, not the date or time, but they knew that the Japanese were planning an attack. And it seldom discussed. It's forgotten. Not that there have not been books written about it. They have, and people at the time knew what was happening. If I have time, I'll briefly play some of a summary lecture. That's the best way I can say it. I have a lot of material on this. Now, I bring it up because nations don't lightly go to war, and this one was actually a declared war, the way it should be. And I'm saying that we shouldn't have. But when you have people trying to provoke another nation, sometimes they succeed and sometimes they don't. But who ultimately pays the price? Not only U.S. soldiers, but also the soldiers of the other nation and the civilians. So it's important. War and peace is a significant issue that must be discussed, must be learned from. Otherwise, we repeat it. And we've been in war after war after war. This is an economist, an historian, Robert Higgs.
Many people are misled by formalities. They assume, for example, that the United States went to war against Germany and Japan only after its declarations of war against these nations in December 1941. In truth, the United States had been at war for a long time before making these declarations. Its war-making took a variety of forms. For example, the U.S. Navy conducted so-called shoot-on-sight convoys that might include British ships in the North Atlantic along the greater part of the shipping route from the United States to Great Britain. Even though German U-boats had orders to refrain, and did refrain, from initiating attacks on U.S. shipping, the United States and Great Britain entered into arrangements to pool intelligence, combine weapons development, test military equipment jointly, and undertake other forms of war-related cooperation. The U.S. military actively cooperated with the British military in combat operations against the Germans, for example, by alerting the British Navy of aerial or marine sightings of German submarines, which the British then attacked. The U.S. government undertook in countless ways to provide military and other supplies and assistance to the British, the French, the Soviets, who were fighting the Germans. The U.S. government also provided military and other supplies and assistance, including warplanes and pilots, to the Chinese, who were at war with Japan. The U.S. military actively engaged in planning with the British Commonwealth countries, and the Dutch East Indies for future combined combat operations against Japan. Most important, the U.S. government engaged in a series of increasingly stringent economic warfare measures that pushed the Japanese into a predicament that the U.S. authorities well understood would probably provoke them to attack U.S. territories and forces in the Pacific region in a quest to secure essential raw materials that the Americans, British, and Dutch government in exile had embargoed. Consider these summary statements by George Victor. And by the way, George Victor is by no means a Roosevelt basher, and it's the other way around. He greatly admires Roosevelt and entirely approves of the actions Roosevelt took to bring the United States into the war. So that's why I think he makes a good source for my purposes. You know, he didn't set out to provide grist for my mill. He has a very nice book, however, called The Pearl Harbor Myth, which I believe is completely honest and well done in its documentation. I'm going to read a long excerpt from that book by George Victor. Roosevelt had already led the United States into war with Germany in the spring of 1941, into a shooting war on a small scale. From then on, he gradually increased U.S. military participation. Japan's attack on December 7 enabled him to increase it further and to obtain a war declaration. Pearl Harbor is more fully accounted for as the end of a long chain of events, with the U.S. contribution reflecting a strategy formulated after France fell in the spring of 1941. In the eyes of Roosevelt and his advisors, the measures taken early in 1941 justified a German declaration of war on the United States, a declaration that did not come to their disappointment. Roosevelt told his ambassador to France, William Bullitt, that U.S. entry into war against Germany was certain, but must wait for an incident, which he was confident the Germans would give us. Establishing a record in which the enemy fired the first shot was a theme that ran through Roosevelt's tactics. He seems eventually to have concluded, correctly as it turned out, that Japan would be easier to provoke into a major attack on the United States than Germany would be. Still reading from George Victor, the claim that Japan attacked the United States without provocation was typical rhetoric. It worked because the public did not know that the administration had expected Japan to respond with war to anti-Japanese measures it had taken in July 1941. Expecting to lose a war with the United States and lose it disastrously, Japan's leaders had tried with growing desperation to negotiate. On this point, most historians have long agreed. Meanwhile, evidence has come out that Roosevelt and Hull persistently refused to negotiate. Japan offered compromises and concessions, which the United States countered with increasing demands. It was after learning of Japan's decision to go to war with the United States if the talks, quote, break down, that Roosevelt decided to break them off. According to Attorney General Francis Biddle, Roosevelt said he hoped for an incident in the Pacific to bring the United States into the European war. It's the end of my quote from George Victor. These facts and numerous others that point in the same direction are, for the most part, anything but new. Many of them have been available to the public since the 1940s. As early as 1953, anyone might have read a collection of heavily documented essays on various aspects of U.S. foreign policy in the late 1930s and early 1940s, edited by Harry Elmer Barnes, that showed the numerous ways in which the U.S. government bore responsibility for the country's eventual engagement in World War II. Showed, in short, that the Roosevelt administration wanted to get the country into the war and worked craftily along various avenues to ensure that sooner or later it would get in, preferably in a way that would unite public opinion behind the war by making the United States appear to have been the victim of an aggressor's unprovoked attack. As Secretary of War Henry Stimson testified after the war, quote, "We needed the Japanese to commit the first overt act," close quote. At present, however, 70 years after these events, probably not one American in 1,000, maybe not one in 10,000, has an inkling of any of this history. So effective has been the pro-Roosevelt, pro-American, pro-World War II faction that in this country it has utterly dominated teaching and popular writing about U.S. engagement in the so-called Good War. Now, I want to retrace my steps here, providing a little more context for what I've just said and some additional details. In the late 19th century, Japan's economy began to grow and to industrialize rapidly. Because Japan has few natural resources, many of its burgeoning industries had to rely on imported raw materials, such as coal, iron ore or steel scrap, tin, copper, bauxite, rubber, and petroleum. Without access to such imports, many of which came from the United States or from European colonies in Southeast Asia, Japan's industrial economy would have ground to a halt. By engaging in international trade, however, the Japanese had built a moderately advanced industrial economy by 1941. At the same time, they built a military-industrial complex to support an increasingly powerful army and navy. These armed forces allowed Japan to project its power into various places in the Pacific and East Asia, including Korea and northern China, much as the United States had used its growing industrial might to equip armed forces that projected U.S. power into the Caribbean, Latin America, and even as far away as the Philippine Islands. When Franklin D. Roosevelt became president in 1933, the U.S. government fell under the control of a man who disliked the Japanese and harbored a romantic affection for the Chinese because, some writers have speculated, Roosevelt's ancestors had made money in the China trade. Roosevelt also disliked the Germans in general, and Adolf Hitler in particular, and he tended to favor the British in his personal relations and in world affairs. He did not pay much attention to foreign policy, however, until his New Deal began to peter out in 1937. Thereafter, he relied heavily on foreign policy to fulfill his political ambitions, including his desire for re-election to an unprecedented third term. When Germany began to rearm and to seek Lebensraum aggressively in the late 1930s, the Roosevelt administration cooperated closely with the British and the French in measures to oppose German expansion. After World War II commenced in 1939, this U.S. assistance grew ever greater and included such measures as the so-called Destroyer Deal and the deceptively named Lend-Lease Program. In anticipation of U.S. entry into the war, the British and U.S. military staffs secretly formulated plans for joint operations. U.S. forces sought to create a war-justifying incident by cooperating with the British Navy in attacks on German U-boats in the North Atlantic. But Hitler refused to take the bait, thus denying Roosevelt the pretext he craved for making the United States a full-fledged declared belligerent, belligerence that the great majority of Americans opposed. In June 1940, Henry Stimson, who had been Secretary of War under Taft and Secretary of State under Hoover, became Secretary of War again. Stimson was a lion of the Anglophile Northeastern upper crust and no friend of the Japanese. In support of the so-called open-door policy for China, Stimson favored the use of economic sanctions to obstruct Japan's advance in Asia. Treasury Secretary Henry Morgenthau and Interior Secretary Harold Ickes vigorously endorsed this policy. Roosevelt hoped that such sanctions would goad the Japanese into making a rash mistake by launching war against the United States, which would bring in Germany because Japan and Germany were allied. The Roosevelt administration, while curtly dismissing Japanese diplomatic overtures to harmonize relations, accordingly imposed a series of increasingly stringent economic sanctions on Japan. In 1939, the United States unilaterally terminated the 1911 commercial treaty with Japan. On July 2, 1940, Roosevelt signed the Export Control Act, authorizing the president to license or prohibit the export of essential defense materials. Under this authority, on July 31st, exports of aviation motor fuels and lubricants and number one heavy melting iron and steel scrap were restricted. Next, in a move aimed at Japan, Roosevelt slapped an embargo, effective October 16, on all exports of scrap iron and steel to destinations other than Britain and the nations of the Western Hemisphere. Finally, on July 26, 1941, Roosevelt froze Japanese assets in the United States, thus bringing commercial relations between the nations to an effective end. 1 week later, Roosevelt embargoed the export of such grades of oil as were still in commercial flow to Japan. The British and the Dutch followed suit, embargoing exports to Japan from their colonies in Southeast Asia. Roosevelt and his subordinates knew they were putting Japan in an untenable position and that the Japanese government might well try to escape the stranglehold by going to war. Having broken the Japanese diplomatic code, the American leaders knew, among many other things, what Foreign Minister Toyoda had communicated to Ambassador Nomura in July 31st. I read from that message, "Commercial and economic relations between Japan and third countries, led by England and the United States, are gradually becoming so horribly strained that we cannot endure it much longer. Consequently, our empire, to save its very life, must take measures to secure the raw materials of the South Seas." Close quote. This was a message U.S. leaders read as of the end of July 1941. They knew the position Japan was in perfectly well. Because American cryptographers had also broken the Japanese naval code, the leaders in Washington also knew that Japan's measures would include an attack on Pearl Harbor. Yet they withheld this critical information from the commanders in Hawaii, who might have headed off the attack or prepared themselves better to defend against it. That Roosevelt and his chieftains did not ring the tocsin makes perfect sense. After all, the impending attack constituted precisely what they had been seeking for a long time. As Stimson confided to his diary after a meeting of the War Cabinet on November 25, 1941, quote, "The question was how we should maneuver them into firing the first shot without allowing too much danger to ourselves." Close quote. After the attack occurred, Stimson confessed that, quote, "My first feeling was of relief, that a crisis had come in a way which would unite all our people." Thank you very much.
I'm going to close out the show, but I want to really recommend you listen to How the U.S. Economic Warfare Provoked Japan's Attack on Pearl Harbor by Robert Hicks. You see, the United States had broken the diplomatic code as well as the naval code. So we knew what the Japanese were thinking, planning, if you will. And why would Japan attack Pearl Harbor? It was a surprise attack. But what provoked it? What did the United States do? Well, FDR made sure that there was an oil embargo on Japan, as well as an embargo on scrap metal. Japan was very much reliant, it's a resource-poor country, relying on imports from other countries. And at that time, a lot of oil, and scrap iron were coming from the United States, and a lot of their exports were to the United States. Sounds kind of familiar. You see, trade wars do lead to real wars, and in this case, it did lead to a real war, a war with Japan. And what changed overnight? You had Americans demanding a declaration of war and people volunteering to serve in the military service. And then Hitler made a mistake. A couple of days later, he declared war on the United States. You see, Churchill and Roosevelt were trying to provoke, really, Germany, Hitler, into an attack on the United States to get the United States on in war and get the people of the United States, the public opinion in the United States, for another world war. They weren't for it until Pearl Harbor. So, yes, public opinion can be changed rather quickly. But what you didn't know, and what few Americans know, is that bit of history I've given you. There have been books written about it. The surprise attack truly wasn't a surprise. And if you push anyone's back to the wall, and that's exactly what we were doing with Japan, they attacked. Had we not had an embargo, oil as well as metal and other commodities, I don't think there would have been a war with Japan. Note I said Japan. Probably still a war with Germany. You see, what we're really seeing here, and we saw it in World War I, is wars between empires. And in World War I, there were four empires that lost. They were on the wrong side. The Russian Empire, the German Empire, the Austrian-Hungary or Habsburg Empire, and the Ottoman Empire. In this war, we saw the end of the Japanese Empire, definitely any remains of a German Empire. But because Great Britain fought in two world wars, it eventually lost its empire because many of the countries sought independence from Great Britain, just like we did in the 1700s. In the 1940s and 50s and 60s, many former colonies of Great Britain became independent. And yes, after the Cold War was over, definitely no Russian Empire. So wars are fought between nations, but you need to look at the entire history, not just what you read in the textbooks. It didn't happen by accident. It did happen overnight, but it was not an accident. That's why you need to be very, very careful, because today we don't even go through the formality of authorizing a war, even though that's what the United States Constitution insists upon. We have the Korean War, the Vietnam War, Iraq War twice, Afghanistan, and many, many, many minor interventions. You see, the American Republic today has become the American Empire. We need to learn from history, not repeat it over and over and over again. You can make a case for all these wars, and that's what politicians do. Only much later, usually after the war, after many people have died, to begin to get some of the information as to what was really happening. And yes, public opinion is difficult to change, but it was changed by having another nation attack us. And we did it by provoking them. Call it sanctions. That's what they do call it today. Sanctions. And we have sanctions on North Korea, the Islamic Republic of Iran, Russia, and many other nations. Can it lead to war? You better believe it can lead to war. And there are those in government as well as outside of government. War is profitable. War is big business. War is jobs. But war leads to people losing their lives. Not only our soldiers, but those we go to war with. Civilians, innocent and otherwise. War, and the United States and its people have had its fill of wars, is what happens when you have huge government. And when you have a situation of a recession or depression, it's very, very tempting to solve that problem by going to war, because immediately you solve most, if not all, of the unemployment problem. You draft them, or you have volunteers. So you need to be aware that you have people promoting big government, and invariably big government, and it started in the 30s, folks. The federal government got bigger and bigger, and it led to war after war after war, and the sacrifice of, in World War II, nearly 300,000 lives. And the United States, relative to other nations, got off light. The Soviet Union, if you look at both military and civilian deaths, over 25 million, folks, 25 million. And yes, the warring parties, whether they're Japan or Germany, lost millions as well. So the fatalities, the casualties, the wounded of these wars is large. Have we learned much? Well, we certainly have not ended war. We certainly intervene in country after country. And there's always good reasons. There are always good reasons. And there are always politicians that will give you the good reasons. And there are always people that will volunteer. But we fundamentally have not addressed the problem of big government leading to intervention after intervention. With that, I want to leave you with America the Beautiful.
My name is Raymond Thomas Pronk, the presenter of the Pronk Pop Show. Views expressed on this show are my own, unless otherwise stated, and do not reflect the opinion of KDUX Web Radio, Richland College, or the Dallas County Community College District. You are listening to KDUX Web Radio, broadcasting live from Richland College in Dallas, Texas. We're the voice of Richland College. You are listening to the Pronk Pop Show, presented by Raymond Thomas Pronk, the People's Paladin Pronk, propagating faith, family, friends, freedom first. Broadcasted by Renaissance Radio, Radiating Reason, and KDUX Web Radio. Podcasted by PronkPops.wordpress.com. and KDUX Web Radio.wordpress.com.